Hello, and welcome to episode 151 of the Planning Period Podcast, part of the On Podcast Media Network. I'm your host, Brad Treffler. This week on the show, I'm joined by Alexis Wiggins. Alexis is a high school English teacher, former instructional coach, and author of The Best Class You Never Taught. Former guest Craig Randall connected us and said that Alexis would make a great guest on the show, so I invited her on. Alexis and I talk about her experience dealing with her father, Grant Wiggins' legacy, her experiences teaching and living all over the world, the struggles of living and teaching in the post-fact era, how the U.S. education funding model by nature creates inequities that never stop, the value of teaching film, and how a great teacher will drive your curiosity. So, sit back and enjoy episode 151 of the Planning Period Podcast, my interview with Alexis Wiggins. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of the Planning Period Podcast. I am your host, as always, Brad Treffler, and tonight I am joined by someone who, I don't know, this doesn't even make any sense, but I'm going to say is like half blind date, half like actual recommendation of somebody. So I feel like I have a little bit of knowledge about this person, but it was definitely a hookup that someone else made for us. Like Craig Randall, in fact, I think is the person that tagged this guest into a tweet from me. But so tonight I'm joined by Alexis Wiggins. How are you doing today?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing well. You know, we had a nice little chat before we started. You know, we got the whole like the world is chaos stuff out of the way, which I think is just like prerequisite for any conversation at this point. And now we can chat education tonight. So I'm excited.
Me too.
So Alexis, for my audience, if you could give us an introduction to who you are and what's your space in education.
Sure. I've been teaching or working in schools off and on for about 20 years now. Both my parents were teachers. My dad, some people may know, was Understanding by Design, Grant Wiggins of Wiggins and McTighe. And so I was introduced to sort of the love of learning and pedagogy and education very early on. Never wanted to be a teacher because both my parents were teachers. But of course wound up loving it and started in independent schools in the Northeast in the school systems that I grew up in. And my husband and I found our way to overseas schools and did international teaching off and on for many years. And we're currently living and working at an independent school in the Texas area. And I've worked as a high school English teacher, Spanish teacher, history teacher, instructional coach. I'm an ASVD author of the book, The Best Class You Never Taught. And just kind of like an education nerd, basically.
I love education nerds. They're great people. They're great. They make terrible party guests. I know because I am one, and I make a terrible party.
True.
Guest. The worst thing that can happen to me at a party, and I don't know if you share this, but the worst thing that can happen to me at a party is somebody's like, I mean, first of all, being at a party would be wonderful at this point, so I'll be glad to take that. But I'm going to digress. you know, someone goes, oh, I'm a teacher. And I go, ooh, I'm going to talk to you for the next 2 hours about instructional design. That's happening.
Yeah.
And, you know, they just like slowly want to walk away because most teachers don't actually want to do that, which is weird. I don't know what's wrong with them. But
I agree. Yeah.
Good times. Or the other side of it, when like they say, so like they're a parent will be like, oh, my kid goes to this school. What do you think about that one? And like, well, I think a lot about that one, but should I say it? I don't know.
Yeah, it's best always to play it politically safe with the with the name game.
It's a good move. So tell me, you know, your dad being, you know, fairly well known in the education space, I would say. I mean, his work is pretty pivotal. You know, is that... I don't really know the question I'm going with here. So I'm just going to kind of like throw it. I don't know. Go with it. Like, does that kind of weigh on you? Does that something that excites you? Is it something that drives you? I don't know. What does that do for you?
Yeah. I never thought about it when I was younger. You know, my parents were divorced. I didn't grow up with my dad. He had another marriage and another set of kids. And I didn't see him that often actually when I was growing up. you know, so I would be in school and teachers would go, my teachers would go to a conference of his or something and, you know, mention something. And I never really knew what he did. I remember I kept asking him, I think I was applying to college and I, you know, you have to like fill in what your parents do on one of the applications or something. And I think I remember calling him and saying, like, what is it? What education consultant? Like, what is that? So I never really understood it until I was older. And I think actually, you know, for any listeners who knew or know of his work and don't know, he passed away. He died of a heart attack about 5 years ago now. And it was very unexpected. And, you know, I think in the time that I'm in my early 40s now, so kind of my early 20s to my mid 30s, late 30s, you know, we grew really close kind of through pedagogy, because I hadn't grown up with him, that was really our connection. And so, you know, I would call him and always kind of get his take on something. You know, I had sort of an instinct that something was right, but I was getting pushback from students or parents or admin. And I'd sort of say, well, what do you think about this? And so he, you know, in my 20s and 30s was just, you know, the greatest mentor I had. And really helped, I think, sharpen my view of teaching and learning and gave me the courage to really follow my heart in the classroom and do what I know is really great teaching and learning. And he always sort of advocated for that unapologetically, publicly as well, but it was really comforting to be able to call him up and say, you know, the first 100 pages of 1984 is a drag. It, you know, Orwell needed a better editor and it's too slow. And I'm thinking about, you know, letting the kids kind of skim that part and do summaries and then just get into it because I have a lot of ELL learners. Like, what do you think? And I'd be like, yep, I think that makes good sense. And, you know, it was just like having someone who was a deep expert and who could talk about anything so knowledgeably, be able to answer all your questions almost anytime. It was really intellectually exciting. I loved that. And I miss it.
Yeah. Cool. That was like nice. That was like a nice story. I feel good about that. I got the warm and fuzzies going on, and I don't think it's just from the wine. That's cool.
He loved wine too. I have a picture of him in my classroom, always inside a cabinet where I keep things, you know, in my classroom. And it's him. The last trip I saw him on, he came and visited me in Spain where my husband's from and where we had a house. And he was toasting us with a big glass of Spanish red wine. And so I ever need an inspiration, I always look to Grant's picture with a nice big glass of red.
I like it. I like it. Huh, man. Well, I don't want to do a whole episode on your dad because that's not why we're here. But I just thought that was really interesting. So I appreciate that. That was a great reflection on that. That was cool. So you've been an English teacher for a long time. You sounds like you've been all over the world. You know, you've been a lot of different places teaching. So what has kind of, now that you're in the US, in Texas, no less, which while it has a lot of cultural diversity, I don't really think of it as a open-minded state in general. What is it like coming with sort of this varied, vast cultural experience you've had and now being back in teaching in the US?
It's so hard to paint any place with a broad brush. I think one of the sort of almost surprising, exciting, but then ultimately obvious discoveries of living anywhere else in the world is that it's like everywhere else in the world. So, you know, Texas, like Saudi Arabia, like Hong Kong, like Spain, all places I've lived, Vermont, there is no one person, way of thinking, way of life that can define it. And in all of those places, the stereotypes are real. And all of those places defy the stereotypes as well. So for example, you know, my family, I'm from the Northeast. I'm from, you know, my family goes back on both sides for generations in New York City. I grew up in Boston. And my family was more worried about me moving to Texas than Saudi Arabia. And I, you know, I still don't really understand why. I think they have a really outdated idea of what Texas is. I live in the Houston area. It's the most diverse city in the country currently. A lot of people don't believe that, but you can Google it. It's true. They do get out every year. They kind of flip with Jersey City. But and it's not just diverse because of, you know, what you'd imagine, like Latino populations, of course, are high. But there's a high African-American population, a high African population, a high Indian and Pakistani population. There's a Chinatown that's vibrant. It's not what people imagine. I think people imagine like JR and Dallas and you know, these very kind of television oil, you know, big hat kind of thing. And so where I live and where I teach, it, you know, I look around my classroom and I might have 7 different passports represented in one classroom. So it's not monolithic. It's not, you know, boring. It's not closed minded, but it is different than other places I've lived. And I think we're all living through a time that's in this country more polarized than ever before. And so that's just a new challenge in teaching, I think, in general. I've taught many times, 1984, and, you know, it's fascinating because a few years ago I was getting a little stale, and then it kind of revived with the election and the politics and people talking about it in the news. I think it shot to number one in Amazon after Trump was elected in 2016. And I remember teaching it again here, and it, not specific to Texas, but just specific to the time we're living in. I remember it was the first time where I would do my spiel, because I always do it, where, you know, we would argue about what truth is. And I would pose the question to students, you know, what, how do you know what's true and what's not? And they would say, well, you know, you have your truth and I have my truth. And they would give the classic moral relativism argument. And I would say, okay, well, I believe the earth is flat. You believe it's round. We're both equally right, because my truth is just as true and valid as yours. And, you know, almost every time you teach it, every time I taught it, they were like, oh, well, no. And a couple years ago, I started to get, well, yeah, from a few of the kids. And I was like, wait, what? That's not in the lesson plan. And so I noticed something fundamentally was shifting about the way that we, as a generation, as a people, as a country, as a world, are thinking about truth, what's real and what's not. And I think now we're seeing so much of that play out in the discussion of films like The Social Dilemma and how we live in these filter bubbles and all those fascinating questions about truth and reality. But kind of back to your question, because I'm getting far away from it, but I swear it's still connected. I think that we, you know, no matter where you are in the world, people are fundamentally the same. And that has been one of the greatest joys that I have discovered as a teacher, that, you know, everywhere I've been, students want to learn, they're engaged. If the teaching is engaging, if you treat young people like intellectual adults, they respond. And so I don't think it matters if you're in Saudi Arabia or Hong Kong or Vermont or Texas. I think you treat young people like intellectual adults, and they'll respond. And so I've been happy teaching and living in all of those places as a result.
Interesting. Yeah. I have lots of international teachers on the show, and I think they often come up with a similar vibe. And you nail down specifics on specific areas, and they'll say, you know, some, like you kind of said, some generalizations of certain areas, but obviously everywhere that you go, there's people, and people are unique and different in all of their own thing. The truth and post-truth factors are fascinating to me. Terrifying, utterly terrifying, but also fascinating. I think that they will have a major impact on education. But I also think, more importantly, they're having a massive impact on our world right now. So it's just interesting to, like, So not talking necessarily about where we are right now, but I mean, how do we teach if we can't say fact? Like, if that word has lost its meaning, then what do we teach?
You know, if the shape of the earth is up for debate, then so is the value of 2 + 2. Like, I can't, and not just as like a tricky little thing your high school math teacher does to show you that proofs can do anything, like, but like literally we're just gonna have kindergartners going, well, I think it's 5 and it is, so too bad. How do we battle that?
That's literally a scene in 1984, and you know, I had this discussion today with my 95-year-old grandmother, who has lived through a lot, and she's more sort of terrified than ever what's happening to the country. And she's always said that education must do better in this country. And I think that it's not just a problem of education. It's fundamentally a problem of sort of what kind of education we're giving the kids, because, you know, content is something, but if we're not teaching students how to recognize what a source is that's valid and what a source is that's not, and we're not teaching them to examine their own minds and their own biases and cognitive biases and logical fallacies, if we're not teaching them to be discerning consumers of everything, not just media, but, you know, critically push back on Macbeth and, you know, whether Shakespeare was portraying Lady Macbeth, you know, fairly or unfairly in her characterization as a bloodthirsty lady. I think we have to, the phrase is sort of hackneyed, but I think critical thinker has never been more important. I think it is the fundamental skill that we need right now. And I was just talking with some colleagues the other day, because we do this 1984 unit. I don't teach that course right now, but with it, we do a media bias unit, and we have students look through a variety of media, some they know, some they don't, you know, names they'd recognize, like CNN or Fox or, you know, whatever, the typical ones, New York Times, Wall Street Journal. And we have them look at kind of rankings and world freedom rankings, fact check, how many times have these sites failed or not, a fact check. You know, what is their bias? Which sources are ranked the most neutral, which are ranked kind of the most left and right. And we have them do this, you know, really fascinating workshop on it. And the kids every year will say the most neutral. So every year the ranking is usually that AP and Reuters are sort of the most neutrally ranked. And the kids will say, yeah, well, they're boring. They're written in a boring way. And it's not a cynical comment. They're just stating sort of fact that it's written in a factually reported boring way. And they notice accurately, I think, that the most biased, you know, the furthest left and the further left and right you go on the scale, the more insulting the language, the more colorful the language, the more they appeal to pathos, to your emotions. And so we start to give them the tools to recognize this. We study ethos, logos, and pathos. We give them these tools to recognize how media is using language and using the tools of rhetoric to reach its audience and ultimately sell them something, because if it bleeds, it leads. And, you know, we teach them that a headline is almost never written by the writer itself. It's usually written by an editor. It's clickbait. You know, we try to teach them that where there's money to be made, there will be people trying to make money. And so they need to be smart and savvy consumers, and they need to ask questions. And so this year was the first year that to that worksheet I made a few years ago, I added who owns this media source. And what other companies or media sources do they own? Because I keep reading about the closing of all the local media sources and just the consolidation of media. And I think it's a fascinating question that a lot of young people aren't really aware of. A lot of people aren't aware of. And how is that affecting how we get our sources of information and what we know about it? So anyway, It's a long-winded answer because I'm good at those. But I think basically the most important skill facing us is about this. And I think a lot of adults my age and older are really clueless. Like, I don't think we really pay enough attention to how quickly it's changing and how little we've kind of educated the current generations in how to do this well. I think we're behind technologically, our generation, you know, kind of Gen X and up, and we need to really get with it so we can teach students the skills they need to be savvy media consumers. Because I think we're gonna, find it's a losing battle if we don't quickly figure out how to teach those skills of critical thinking and filtering well. And just one other thought. Politics is tricky. And, you know, I live in a place where it's important to be, you know, not on one side or another. And I think that that is a really important part of my job, to get kids to think critically wherever they are on the spectrum. And one way that we do that as teachers that I highly recommend other schools and teachers do, no matter where in the world they are, like in Saudi Arabia, there were plenty of things I could not talk about that, you know, would have been illegal or, you know, problematic. And I think the way that you can get to all students, no matter what political climate you're living in, is through the lens of research. Is this a source that would be, you know, through our criteria that we use to vet sources, could be used for a research paper? And so we combine the 1984 and the media bias unit with a research paper. And they actually have to find something in today's world that is like 1984. So kids will choose things like Facebook, or they'll choose things like North Korea, or they'll choose things like the Russian bots, or the, you know, the media farm empires in the Baltic. It's fascinating because then it's a really easy question that's not political. Is this a fact? Is it not? Is it, you know, is this a good source? Is it not? It's like, is it going to pass our criteria for what a valid source is for a research paper? Because if not, it's not good. And you might still like to read it. It's someone's very strong opinion about something. It doesn't mean that it's wrong, but that it just means now you have to go and try to find that information elsewhere. If you can't, it's probably not a good source for you for this particular paper. So I think that that is a underappreciated way to approach the factual media questions of today's time.
Interesting. Yeah, you know, the point, there's a lot of points in there, obviously, but I think the one that I'm battling with and thinking about a lot currently is the AP and Reuters are boring. And there was a time where that isn't, right? Like if you think about, like, if I ask my parents, that they'll tell me about how, you know, how if we just had Walter Cronkite back, like everything would be fine, right? Like he was boring. He was so boring. Like if you go back and watch his stuff, he's boring, but he's only boring by a modern standard. And it's, in my most positive modes, I come to saying that we're in this beautiful evolution point where like social media and the democracy and like the decentralization of information has meant that we're in a growing pains of evolution currently. Like the way we consume and create and access media has drastically changed very, very quickly in the evolution of things. I mean, if you look at the grand scheme of things, like we went from none of this at all to all of a sudden all of the world's information, and it can be, I can make anything I want and put it on the internet and make it look completely legit. I mean, I think about when we did search, we did the beginnings of like searching internet search research when I was in school. Like we would look for things like what the website actually looked like and the quality of the site, and that would tell you if it was legitimate or not. No, it takes 2 seconds to build a phenomenal looking website that's totally believable. So like you can't, we're in this like growing pain stage of these are the consequences of a quickly disruptively moving central part of our world. I mean, like the news is so critical and central to how we make decisions in our lives. And now all of a sudden we've completely upended it really, really quickly. And this is the problems with it. And less when I'm in my more cynical moods, it's you know, Fox and CNN and MSNBC all want to be Facebook because Facebook can say whatever the heck they want and no one can fact check them and call the FCC or whatever else. I mean, other than like the FCC going after Facebook. But anyways, general, like no one can go after them. They can say whatever they want. So they're having to compete with, they have to have viewers to keep the thing alive and they have to be able to provide news and factual information. So you get to these, you end up having to polarize your network in order to make entertainment that also maybe is slightly informative. And the question becomes, how do you get around that? Which I don't expect you to have an answer to. I'm just kind of rambling at this point. I don't know that we can solve media tonight, but I just, you know, it's you balance with the combination of post-fact world and the struggle between entertainment and information, you know, and that's, I think it's a struggle teachers juggle when they're, you know, English teachers especially. It's like, how much time do we spend on fiction and how much time do we spend on nonfiction? Because generally kids don't enjoy nonfiction. So how do you, you know, how do you do that? And it's the same struggle that, you know, news networks have every single day, it seems like.
Yeah, I think it can't be controversial to be a fan of truth. And I think what we need to just do is give, in the absence of, you know, tools and language with which to talk about and understand and dissect these things, people will kind of make their own stories and their own versions and their own sort of absolute truth. But I think once, I mean, because I've seen it so many years, year after year, when you give students, you know, a list of here are cognitive biases, here are examples of them. When you give students the tools for rhetorical analysis, you give them names. Like, this is what pathos looks like. Let's look for it in a speech by Martin Luther King. Let's look for it in a speech by Barbara Bush. Here's another rhetorical tool, humor. We actually do a whole unit on humor and have kids study it, which they love. But I think once you, you know, language is such an important part of it. Once you give kids kind of a name and a way to analyze the tools of analysis, they enjoy the process of examining not only the media or a work of literature, as you say, or a speech, but also their own minds. And I think, you know, I've always braced at the idea that, like, education is this sort of liberal indoctrination. The only truth to that, I think, is that it is and should be the tools with which to understand your own mind and to understand the process of how learning itself happens. And if that's a liberal indoctrination, then I'm guilty, because there's no story or version or view or truth that I want students to know that's mine. Nothing could be further from the truth. I actually told my ninth graders the other day, if you think that you've figured out, they were about to write their first really big paper of the year. And, you know, if you think that you've figured out what Ms. Wiggins likes and you're going to give her that, you know, Ms. Wiggins loves cats. So I'm going to write my essay about how a hero is someone who is a cat lover, because Ms. Wiggins liked that. And that's a good strategy. No, you have a terrible strategy for writing a paper. I said, there's nothing I love more than finding a thesis or an argument with which I initially disagree or kind of bristle at. And then a student goes through and proves it. And I think that we need, as teachers, to encourage creative, critical, unorthodox thinking all the time, even if we're uncomfortable with some of it. I think it's really important to welcome discourse. I think that is a vital, that's the lifeline of education. And so, I just think these are things we can't shy away from in difficult times. We have to lean into.
I like it. You know, we've already gotten pretty good, and you did a great job of bringing us back to education, because I was all the way off in left field with you there for a little bit. So good on you. I'm glad you are an excellent podcast host. But with that in mind, let's move into my first question for all my guests. And of course, my first question for all my guests is, what is the biggest problem facing education today?
Well, this is a very opinionated stance, and it's based in my years living in a country like Spain. And I really believe the biggest problem in education today is that it's the public education in America is funded locally, so that in wealthy areas, you have well-funded, well-resourced schools. And in poor areas, you have schools with less money, less resources, less opportunity for students. In a place like Spain, every student in the country is funded per capita the same way. They don't even understand how we could use local taxes to fund our education system, because it just creates inequities that never stop. And I'm sure there are historical reasons that I don't fully understand for why we do it that way, but I think it is the single greatest threat to our democracy, to be honest. I've never understood why we continue to do that. I mean, I understand cynically why we continue to do that, but I've never really understood as a nation why we haven't tried to stop funding our schools that way. And I speak as someone who attended public school at different points in my life, but has never taught public school. So I want to be clear. I have been a career private and international school teacher only because I went an untraditional route to teaching, and I didn't have teaching certification and training. You know, I was able to kind of enter the independent school world that I grew up in straight out of college practically, and then went back and, you know, got certification after I'd been teaching for a long time. But you know, I just never wound up being a public school teacher for all kinds of reasons, not because I didn't want to. So I benefit from this system. I get to teach in private schools that are phenomenal, well-resourced. My kids have gone to several of the international and private schools that I've taught at. I feel really blessed, and I don't understand why, you know, a great public school like in the area where I live isn't in every county, every city. I think it's unconscionable.
So I think it might have been episode 100 when I my dad interviewed me on that episode, and I think I landed on funding as the biggest problem in education, if I remember right. It was either that or politics, but they're both screwed up and they're both connected. But I'm lucky as well. While Florida education certainly does not rank among the top like 40, it's not great by any stretch. The one of the things we do right, and I was faced with this in my master's program, is our state funding model actually works, which is really nice. And the reason is because the state handles distribution of all funds and does it equally to the whole state. So there's a equitable, I should say equitably, not equally. There's a state funding model. It is every kid is worth $4,376, I think, or something like that, give or take. And then there is a local area multiplier based on cost of living in that area. So it's, you know, a 0.1% here and there. So it's not drastic. We have a model that allows for that, for somewhat of the elimination of that inequity, right? Like, where instead of saying that the local area school in the highly affluent area has all the funds, now all the schools in the area spread those funds out, which is nice. Now there's plenty of other ways that affluent areas manage to overfund their schools. Yeah. Don't get me wrong, but at least from that portion of it, that does not by any stretch mean that the inequities are gone. But when I think about that and I learn that, I realize that there are solutions we could put in place in different states and different areas to start to fix some of these things. And it just doesn't seem to happen. And I mean, like you, I've never heard a good argument for why it's funded the way it is. The only reason I can think historically is racism. I'm just going to throw it out there, because like, I can't think of a single other valid reason to do this the way we do.
I'd have to talk to a historian, and history is not my forte, but I'm sure it has to do with states' rights and all those kinds of things. But I don't know enough about the history of education policy to know sort of how it started. But I actually didn't know that about Florida at all. That's fascinating. I'd love to know the origins of that. That's really interesting. Yeah, model. I don't mean to suggest, like, I am no expert on education policy. I am a classroom teacher and a pedagogy nerd and like a curriculum and instruction like freak. So please don't ask me to fix America's education, because I really don't know. I just know how to do what I do in the classroom. But I think, I think equity is an issue on all kinds of levels, including education. And it's not to say that, like you said, it fixes everything. You know, Spain doesn't rank very highly nationally, internationally either, even though they have a more equitable system. But I think that the gaps are growing, and I see this right now, like, the disconnect between people who are seeing reality. I don't even mean politics right now, but just, I read a statistic the other day that 25%, it was 2014, they did a study, but 25% of Americans believe that the sun revolves around the earth from 6 years ago. And I just thought, yeah, that sounds about right, And I think facts like that sort of alarm me, and I think reveal some of the inequities. Maybe everyone's getting an education, but what does that education look like, and how well are the teachers paid in all of the schools in all of the states, and how well are they trained, and how much access do they have to advanced degrees that aren't going to crush them with debt, and it's, what are the incentives to go into teaching in general? Like, I love it, and I found it very easy because I just went into the world that I knew, and they accepted me at very low pay, and I worked my way up. And I that's the beauty of private school, is you're not giving tests to kids, you're not held accountable, you're not given great, you're held accountable, but you're not like, the state tests don't, aren't tied to your performance and things like that. And so people feel the freedom to be able to teach well and what they know and what they love best. And the less effective teachers get worked out of the system because there are no unions and things like that. And there has to be a better way. There has to be a way that it's never going to be equal, but there has to be a way where it's a lot more equal. My soapbox on that question.
Interesting. You said something, and now we're going to, I'm going to change directions again, because I can hear my dad's voice in my head right now going at this commentary. You mentioned that, the private schools are not held accountable to tests, right? Like, to tests specifically. And you did say that people without, less effective teachers are pushed out of the system, give or take. That they're the argument that teachers would make, in that public school teachers would make, would that mean that they're not safe, they're not protected, they have no guarantee of a job, that an administrator could come in and just wipe them out without a union or without protection, without, tenure and all those things. And the argument that people would make from the outside as well is that accountability is important. We should be held accountable to if our students are learning or not on some level.
Definitely. I mean, definitely people need to be held accountable for student learning. I don't know that a state test is the best way to do that. I'm treading into areas that my dad would be able to talk about very knowledgeably, but I really don't have the expertise to be able to speak for public school teachers and what they need. I think they probably know better than I do, having never taught in one. But I think the larger an organization or system, the harder it is to manage. It's a big, massive ship, right? And I think I've always taught in schools that are relatively small and pretty nimble. Doesn't mean they're always, great, or I myself had wonderful public and private school education, had plenty of not great teachers and, bad situations or what, I don't think there's a perfect panacea. But I think that everyone really needs to be able to decide for themselves kind of which system they feel best suits them and their strengths really fit. And at one point, I remember maybe 10 years ago or so, saying to my dad, you know, kind of hemming and hawing, and, you know, I just feel like I could do more good in a public school than working with, you know, very privileged kids, very capable kids. And I remember he said to me very bluntly, I think you'd burn out in 2 or 3 years. You'd bump up against a lot of the bureaucracy and you'd hate it. Because the truth is, the way that I love to teach, I think is really effective. And it's the way that, it's the only way I know how. It's how I was taught. It's how my parents raised me. You know, it's about deep thinking. It's about deep questioning. It's high challenge. My dad's philosophy, which he instilled in me, is that your job as a teacher is not to impart any kind of knowledge. It is to find the individual talent inside every single student and develop it. And I take that very, very seriously. Wherever a kid is, I'm going to meet him and I'm going to raise the bar. And I've been lucky to be in places where I can do that with a lot of support and well-resourced. And, you know, I have 20 kids max in a classroom where I am. They are all, you know, highly motivated or have parents who want them to be highly motivated. That's a very different story than teaching in a school where students aren't eating. I can't speak about that experience because I've never lived it. And so I think if people, you know, need and want those systems in which they work, like, please keep them. I have no opinion on unions or any of that. I've just never experienced it. I couldn't get an opinion about it.
Interesting. I like it. Yeah, good. That's good. I appreciate that. I think most people would try to give an answer. So I appreciate that. Yeah. So, all right. So let's go to my next question for all my guests. And my next question, of course, is, and you may well have talked about this because we've kind of been all over the place tonight, but what is something you're doing that you wish all educators would do?
Teaching film. I think it is the best way to teach some of the most important lessons. I love reading and writing. Don't get me wrong. I'm an English major, an MFA, and, you know, a career English teacher. But I think film is one of the easiest ways to reach kids on a very deep level. This is a very visual generation. They're a very media savvy generation. And I think some of the best work I've ever done is happening in the last few years. I taught film in a couple iterations in the last 15 years, but now I have a senior course that counts as a year-long English course. So they can sign up for different English classes in their senior year. They can take AP and or Shakespeare, film, contemporary literature. Those are our three other options right now. And this year we have almost half the seniors taking film. Because it's kind of grown in popularity and now there are other teachers teaching it. And, you know, we spend a semester on the classics and I have a very STEM heavy crowd. You know, this is Exxon territory where I live. There are a lot of engineers and doctors and their kids at the school. And so it's not an artsy place. So, you know, getting kids in my class to have a deep 70-minute discussion on Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey is a real coup, and I'm very proud of it. But it's some of the best, I mean, two of the best discussions I've ever heard, because discussion's my thing, right? And so two of the best discussions in my career that I've witnessed, student-led discussions, were in the past 2 years. One was on the film Parasite, and the other was on this year's 2001 A Space Odyssey. And I think that it is a quick way in to wake up intellectual minds, curiosity about the world, about other cultures, about people who are different than ourselves. And some students will get that through reading, but not all. But I think almost all students can get it through film. And I think more teachers and schools should get on the train.
I think I'm just going to co-sign that one. Like, yep. Stamp of approval. I'm a former English teacher, was not an English major, but I mean, I loved reading and writing as a kid. I read and wrote constantly. And, you know, I literally tonight had tears in my eyes because they announced that they're making a Rogue Squadron movie. And I like was obsessed with those books as a kid. And now like I'm crying thinking about it again. Anyways,
I saw you tweet about Patty Jenks.
It's everything. That trailer, I like literally, I had a lot of emotions just in that teaser. It happened. It was a thing. Anyways, I move on. So power of film, 100% all in on that. I think there is a large contingent of teachers, people, artists, literary types who look down on the medium as some sort of like, you know, simplification or reduction or, you know, of what they believe true art to be. And it is so absurd to me because to me it's storytelling. And absolutely. It is, and if you are getting a story across, whether it's through a song or a musical or a movie or a book or a poem, like the story is what matters. That's the thing humans connect with. And that's the reason literature exists, is so that we can tell stories and connect to each other. And film allows us to do that, you know.
And how many of those same artists and writers and intellectuals and teachers who look down on it go home and stream all their favorite content, which is, you know, people are writing, they're directing, they're using math, they're using technology to accomplish all of those feats among many at collaboration, right? These are all skills that we actually want our students to have. And so I think it's one of the highest art forms that exists. It's not the only one. But I think that, you know, today, not to mention that it's so democratized now because every kid has a camera in their back pocket. And today was the day that my seniors turned in their exam, and their exam is a 2 to 4 minute film based on what they'd learned in the course. And one student turned in this trippy, weird film that she wrote inspired by David Lynch, who she studied on her own. And she posted it on Snapchat on Monday, and it has 300,000 shares or views or whatever. I don't use Snapchat today. And, you know, this is a really cool, young, artistic young woman who has now put her artistic vision out into the world and has had 300,000 people view it. How many of those snooty literary intellectuals can say that their work has had that impact? So I think we need to reconsider what we're asking for, what skills we want to develop, and what media best teaches that. I remember hearing Heidi Hayes Jacobs 20 years ago say, how many of us have taught a screenplay, not a play, but a screenplay as a text? And then she said, okay, film's been around 100 years. Just think about that. And that really stuck with me. I still haven't taught a screenplay to this day, maybe I should. But it's a fascinating question. Why are we so scared of these media? It's because we weren't taught them. I mean, I was lucky enough. I had a Vietnam history class that was Vietnam through film. And we would, you know, go to class during the day. And once a week, we would come to school at night and watch a film every week. And I think that was a formative experience for me. I remember watching The Deer Hunter at like 17 and having my mind blown. And I think that, yeah, I had a very young teacher, and I think she was very passionate about her subject. And I think that really carried over to me. And I think that we have to I don't think it's any lesser of a form. I think we have to use all the forms that we have that are high art. And I think film is no exception to that. And, you know, I think it accomplishes a lot. And it's also quite literary. Like, I have students writing film reviews, and they're really freaking good. It takes a while because it's not of a genre they're used to. But some of our most struggling writers, kids with learning differences and challenges, have written some of the best, funniest, most engaging stuff. I mean, they could be professional film critics. So I think it offers great opportunities for all kinds of students. And I've seen some of the highest, you know, highest achieving English students and some of the most struggling English students both thrive in a course like film. So it's a win across the board for me. I've seen it happen for 10 years. I'm a big fan.
Nice. Yeah. I'm gonna add to my cosign television, not just movies, but then I'm going to move along because I think television is in the greatest era it has ever been in. And storytelling has, I think in a lot of cases, television storytelling has surpassed movies at this point. But that's maybe a hot take. I don't care. We're moving on. I love television. Streaming has completely.
I would love to teach a television class. I think that might explode the heads of some parents and administrators at this point. But I'm hoping maybe we can get there.
talk about pathos. Like, just watch the final episode of like Scrubs after watching all of that show. I mean, that's waterworks every time. Come on. Anyways. I digress repeatedly. That's all I do on this show. Let's get to my last question. My last question for all my guests, of course, is who is the greatest teacher you've ever had?
The greatest teacher I ever had. I've had so many, but the one I think that always sticks with me is Mr. Baker. And he was the headmaster of my high school and my English teacher. He was, you know, the head of school, very busy, you know, being head of school, but he always taught one class and I took two of his classes. I took his Literature of the South my senior year in high school. And it was the hardest class I've ever taken to this day. We read basically a novel a week, like William Faulkner and Eudora Welty and, you know, all these great Southern writers, a week. And then we would write a paper on it every week. And I never did as much work, I think, in the rest of my entire academic career, not even grad school. And I worked so hard for a B. I was never prouder of a grade in my whole life as that B, because it was so in over my head. He was so challenging. But he made me curious, and I was always kind of hunting for deeper insights. I felt like I wasn't smart enough, but I wanted to be smarter. So I was just trying to sharpen that tool all the time. And he made me want to do that. And he's still teaching. I saw a tweet the other day that he was teaching, you know, his Chimera course from his hospital bed via Zoom at 81. He was recovering from a hip replacement. And I just thought, yep, that's Bakes. You know, that's who I want to be. I want to be, you know, hopefully not teaching from my hospital bed, but if I had to, you know, like he could be playing golf, but he would never do that. He took a sabbatical and he spent the entire year reading. And I love that. I look up to him and I hope to be half the teacher and mentor that he was to me, to other students.
Yeah. I'm not entirely sure where to take that.
Someone once asked me why I liked him so much. And I said, I think it was because I knew I was never the smartest in the class, not even close. I was, you know, I wasn't the brightest kid ever in his courses. I always really had to work and work to not quite understand everything, to be honest. And he still made me feel really special. And he, you know, he once told me that what I was trying to do in a paper, if I did it, would be better than an A. And I remember thinking, oh, wow, what, you know, is there something better than an A? That's cool. And so he kind of had ideas about, you know, who you could be as an intellectual. And I hope I do that for students. That's what I'd like to be.
I think that's a good aspiration for any of us to have. Like, I think bringing out the better than the A in our kids. It's, in fact, that's gonna be the title. That's awesome. There we go. That's an episode title.
Bring you out can the thank better. Mr. Baker.
There you go. Wow. Well, Alexis, thank you so much. This has been a lot of fun. This has been a really good chat. I really appreciate your time. It's been awesome.
Yeah, I agree. Thank you. I like nerding out with you.
So for my audience, if they'd like to hear more from you, see more what you're doing, where can you be found?
I can be found on Twitter at the handle Alexis Wiggins, and you can find my book on ASCD or Amazon, or your local indie bookstore is the best choice yet. It's The Best Class You Never Taught by Alexis Wiggins, and it's all about having students run their own amazing in-depth self-evaluated discussions. It'll change your classroom and change your life.
Cool. Yeah, we never even talked about the book. We were 53 minutes and didn't talk about it. You mentioned it in the beginning and I didn't follow up because I'm a terrible host, and here we are. Cool.
Well, something for the super fans, that's all.
Exactly. There you go. Follow it in the, there'll be links in the show notes. That's the thing, right? That's the thing I do. So, man, Alexis, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
Likewise. Thank you.
Alexis, thank you so much for an awesome conversation. It was truly great talking to you. To connect with Alexis, you can find her on Twitter at Alexis Wiggins. Also, check out her book, The Best Class You Never Taught. If you have comments or questions about the show, you can always connect with me on Twitter or Instagram at Brad Schreffler. I love to hear from you all there, and that's also a great place to connect if you'd like to be a guest on the show. Or check out the feedback page on my website that gives you other options for feedback as well, which you can find at bradschreffler.com/feedback. Until next week, go out and teach your way. Music for the Planning Period Podcast is the song Vicious by Kevin MacLeod, used under Creative Commons. You can find him at incompetech.org. The Planning Period Podcast is a proud member of the On Podcast Media Network. You can hear other great shows by hosts such as Mike Washburn, Glenn Irvin, Dan Crinus, and many more by visiting onpodcastmedia.com. The Planning Period Podcast is also a member of the VoiceEd Radio Network. You can hear this show and tons more, including regular live interviews about education, at voiceed.ca. VoiceEd Radio, your voice is right here.